Do we have to record the time now, or we don't have to record the time?
You don't have to.
Under the new rules.
Yep.
This is the last meeting under the old ones.
I didn't quite understand the new ones, but that's okay. We'll get to it.
Well, maybe we'll talk about it during the work session, you know? I'm sure we'll be educated by our highly competent staff.
Okay, the work sessions in, has commenced at 6:02. Can we do roll call here? Marjorie Blom, Commissioner here.
Here, yes.
Rolio.
Here.
Esquire. Bill Brannigan is here. Bob.
Here.
And Mr. Updike.
Here.
And Mr. Capri, the owner of a Tesla. The new owner of a Tesla. Is it an old Tesla?
He's a different generation than the rest of us.
Yeah, next thing you know, he's going 98 miles an hour. That's my girlfriend, they got a rental car, and next thing she was heading to Livermore, and it was 98, whoops.
Yeah, those electric cars can be fast. Okay, so first up is Derek.
Thank you. So I think first up, we've got just kind of review the code changes that relate to what kicked out of the last legislative session. So I've got them up there. I zoomed in so you could actually read it, at least up here. I might be able to do one more here. So I thought I'd just kind of go through this.
Let the record show that Mr. Hanselman has arrived.
I have.
So when we go through this, there's one area you probably caught where there's actual discretion, where you get to actually decide something. The balance of it, because these are, as we said, mandates that came out of Salem, embedded in statute, you know, we don't have a lot of leeway. We'll start with definitions. These are as spelled out in statute. We don't want to deviate. But there's two, emergency shelter, which was an existing defined term, but relates to legislation that passed, so I'm adding it in under definitions at this point. And then single room occupancy, which was actually in the legislation. They relate to Section 7 and 17 of that omnibus housing bill, House Bill 3395, and I attached a full copy for your reading pleasure as part of your packet. So the next change, and all of these changes are limited to Chapter 14, which would be the zoning ordinance, Chapter 14 of the Municipal Code. So the next change goes is added to the 1403, which is our zoning districts. There'll be two charts we look at. The first one's the residential use chart. See, single room occupancy is added in as a new sub 4. There, allowed in all of our residential zones with a footnote. I'll come back to emergency shelter. Well, might as well just cover it, I guess. It's also plugged in, permitted in all zones, all residential zones, also with its own little footnote. So for the S single room occupancy, it's a building with 4 to 6 units on a lot or parcel in an R1 or R2 zone district, or a combination of buildings of at least 4 units each, subject to the density limitations of an R3 or R4 zone district. And that's consistent with what the legislation called for, which it said, you know, you have to allow them up to, which, well, one, they have to be a minimum of 4 units, and you have to allow up to 6 units on any lot or parcel that allows a single family dwelling. So that picks off your R1 and R2. But then it goes on to say anywhere where you allow multifamily, which would be the R3 and the R4, you have to allow SRO at the same density you would multifamily. And so that's what this is intended to do. And that's how that language is structured. Now.
Emergency shelter, is there a time limit on how long the tenant or the guest stays? Because it's, you say it's a temporary basis for individuals and families.
We're working with the definition above, which I'll go back to. It doesn't really specify a time limit. It just provides, it's on a temporary basis. So, you know, presumably you're not talking about something that's long-term, that anybody who's at a shelter will eventually, you know, that needs longer-term housing will eventually be moved into transitional housing or something that provides a little bit more.
But the shelter structure itself would be quasi-permanent.
Shelter would be a permanent, yes. It could be a permanent building.
So like what they're doing to Dr. Cookson's old office.
Excuse me, you're talking about the one over at 7th and Herbert?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's...
Am I showing my age? Remember Dr. Cookson? Mm-hmm. Okay, there were a few nods.
Yeah, no, when I arrived, it was counseling services.
I think most recently it was the Crossroads Domestic Violence program, yeah.
Yeah, they...
So with emergency shelters, there's the... they have to be permitted. This is the one area where you actually have a little bit of discretion. There are at least a couple standards when you look at the bill provisions that relate to emergency shelters. They say, for example, there has to be adequate access to commercial and medical services, and it cannot pose an unreasonable risk to public health or safety. Those are discretionary. Somebody's got to make a judgment call there. I think the way I structured it, we need to define it in a manner that's consistent with the statute that governs it. And so the definition I'm providing is in the statute that sets out these rules for... Give the governor a call.
Well, it is confusing, right?
Yeah. Well, I get it. I mean, we just had a conditional use hearing on residential facilities here for Samaritan. And you've got different statutes with different occupancy limits for the same thing, depending on which statute you're in and you're trying to reconcile these things. It's just sometimes you're dealing with less than perfect laws. I wouldn't my recommendation is to match the statutory definition.
Could a tent be considered an emergency shelter? Seems to be no defining characteristics of what a shelter is. Does it have to be?
Is a tent a building?
Structure?
Well, it doesn't say that.
Well,
you're inferring that.
No, I'm looking here, a building with 4 to 6 units.
No, that's that footnote goes with this special SRO.
Oh, that's SRO.
Five is one that goes with that.
Yeah. So when it says emergency shelter.
But is that...
I don't know what that means. That means...
Is a tent allowed in R1, R2, and R3 zones?
Well, I mean, the new state statute.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know why. What do they mean by an emergency shelter? Can we pull in a pop-up camper? How about all the derelict RVs that are out on the sides of the road? Can we collect those and set up a derelict RV park for...
Well, it says building, but it says building or cluster of buildings, so I think that takes out vehicles.
Well, Eric, are these
at least they
define
that.
Some of those vehicles, I would even say, probably aren't vehicles because you can't drive them.
They're not movable anymore.
Yeah, so, I mean, I just was curious what, when you say emergency shelter.
Well, if you look at Section 7 of House Bill 3395.
Yes.
That's what that sets out the parameters. And, you know, you're talking about
Your hands are tied then, right?
Correct. This is all spelled out in statute.
33.
Includes sleeping and restroom facilities for clients. Probably knocks out any kind of tent right there for the most part, for the restroom side. Will comply with applicable building code. Then it goes on, talks about
okay.
a whole bunch of stuff in here. At the end of the day, it also says you may require a public hearing, but whatever resulting decision is not a land use decision. So I didn't tie it to one of our land use processes. I was tempted to say a type 3 process, which would take it to planning commission, but then that's a land use process. Probably ought not go there. So that's why I wrote this up, that subject to the requirements of the statute 197.782, an emergency shelter proposed within an R1, R2, or R3 zone district shall be subject to a public hearing before the Newport City Council. The reason I put R1, R2, and R3 is those zones tend to be a little bit further away from the services that, you know, these are supposed to be close to. Adequate access to commercial and medical services. I think it's, my view was it's reasonable to subject, you know, your lower density, if you're going to put a shelter in a lower density residential zone, most of our lower density residential zones are further away from medical services, for example. You could argue R3 shouldn't be on the list. I mean, it's kind of borderline. You could say R1 and R2 require a public hearing. But if you don't do a public hearing, then we decide it at staff level versus the council.
Yeah, why would you eliminate any of the residential zones? I mean, this is going to be, should it come up, this is going to be fairly controversial.
It's going to be a hot button issue.
And I would think that every one of them should have to go through the city council and be subject to public testimony.
Mind you, the council and can't deny it unless they can find that those very limited circumstances are met. So,
well, then why have a public hearing if they can't deny it?
What could be made without?
You don't have to require a public hearing.
Well, I know, but if you're going to say you can have a public hearing if it's a meaningless, if it's just a pro forma, and they can't change it, they can't turn it down, then there's no point.
But that's inconsistent with Derek said that there has to be a finding that it's, you know, reasonable access to the medical and the other.
Yeah, when you go,
there is a basis to turn it down.
Yeah.
If you say it's too far away from PCH or wherever.
Yeah, it would be harder for us to do that with the R4 because that tends to be reasonable. I mean, you could put it all through a public hearing, but your only real discretion here, adequate transportation access to commercial and medical services, a lot of our high density residential's on transit routes, whereas our R1 and R2 wouldn't be. If you want to throw R4 in there, you could, but I think if it's in an R4, it's almost a gimme that it's going to have to be approved by the council, irrespective of what kind of pushback they get.
Our transit doesn't run 24 hours.
I think we have to be careful about you know, if shelters start coming in and we subject them to public hearings and the council's shooting them down on this all of the time, they're just going to say, hey, no.
Well,
there's got to be some place where there's adequate transportation access to commercial and medical services.
I guess I'm in favor of public input, mm-hmm. and I think it would be helpful if, whether it's R1, 2, 3, or 4, that there be a public hearing for the neighbors to have input, and the council can then make that decision. I mean, how many more shelters are you're going to have one here in a commercial area. How many more do you foresee in the future?
Then the other one would be, will not pose any unreasonable risk to public health or safety.
Yeah, and that's the one I think people would focus on if they have enough sense to focus on the criteria, because I don't feel safe with this homeless shelter next door. All right, now that's a health and safety thing. That's my internal, but I can still state that opinion, and the council should be able to take that into consideration.
I'd like to share, you know, my own observation is I went and observed the operation of the temporary shelter at the Episcopal Church and also at the Presbyterian Church. And what I came away with, it was well organized. It wasn't a kind-hearted person saying, oh, you can crash here. You know, there were rules, you had to check in, you had to agree to abide by the rules. There were areas you could go to, there were areas you couldn't enter, and you had to leave the premises by a certain time. And if you didn't leave the premises and go away, because I was concerned, you know, the mouse factory up at the Presbyterian Church, if you don't leave the premises within a certain period after they shut the doors, you're denied access the next night. So, I mean, yeah. I think my feeling on the shelter has kind of softened a bit after watching it actually in operation. Again, I think that has to go to the efforts of the county in running it well. I thought it was going to be the second coming of Grace Wins, but it was much more organized. That's my only comment on it. I guess some of my fears of a shelter, I keep thinking of Burnside in Portland, maybe those have been overblown. Maybe my fears have been overblown.
This is one area you have discretion. So if you want to have require anything in a residential zone to go to council, that's fine. I can draft it that way. There are some high-density residential areas where I think you could make a plausible case that they're not proximate to medical services and whatnot. So...
I think the more public visibility and public input, the better, even if most people are not going to testify to the criteria itself. We get that all the time.
I think this is the place where you'd want to do it, not so much in the commercial zones, because they're already an outright permitted use in a number of commercial zones, so you probably don't want to change that. If it's already an outright permitted use, that's probably fine. But for this one, I'll go ahead and change that then for emergency shelters under the footnote 5, to indicate that it's subject to a public hearing before the council. I can't list it as a C because it's not a conditional use. That's land right. use. So I had to do this.
You can make up a new letter, but that's silly. Yeah. Question for you on the tail end of that chart, U, V, W, and X. They all have asterisks by them, but I don't see the notes corresponding to those asterisks. Okay. Is that just because you extracted a little bit here?
I did. I think they referred. I pulled out the. I believe those referred to the ordinances that adopted them. I'll double check. And I pulled some of that stuff out just for...
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. But you can't do... That drives me crazy. Reading a document, there's a little asterisk. Your eyes go to the bottom of the page and there's nothing there.
All right, so let me add R4 here.
Now, on the public hearing thing that we just discussed, ultimately... Well, let's say this body says we should have public hearings. The city council can say, no, we're not going to have the public hearing.
Yeah, no, they could go a different direction on that if right. they want to.
Okay.
I mean, that's their prerogative.
Right.
This is our recommendation.
We'd have the same conversation. You have some discretionary standards there. If you don't hold a hearing... Then you know you're leaving it to staff to sort through it. You know, that is what it is.
If you do hold public hearings, what would the timeline? That takes a number of times. Should it have to be
21 days?
To get it on and then.
No, you're talking about a hearing,
and then you'd have to have a second hearing.
No,
just one.
It doesn't come here.
No, it doesn't come to City Council.
And we're not talking about land use hearings that have prescribed timelines.
Yeah.
This is totally open-ended. We can, it would just be a public hearing. The council can decide how they want to advertise it.
So it wouldn't be a long delay. That's what I'm, if it's an emergency shelter, time does seem to be of importance. I don't want... legalese to get in trouble. You got to have 21 days for this and 14 more days for that and 120 days to get a decision made. Right. So that's what I'm asking.
Okay. But the city council, it's up to them to decide that.
It could be just up and down and that's fine. But
or they could stretch it out.
They could.
Well, let me explore that point a little more then. So if the public hearing process isn't prescribed, what's the notice process? So if I'm the adjacent property owner, what means would I have to find out that this is proposed next to me? Got to read the paper?
It's you know, I didn't try to prescribe that in here. I could put in things, but, you know, such as a notice parameter in terms of distance, time in advance. I mean, we have those in the land use processes,
right.
But a typical city council public hearing does not.
Exactly.
It's silent about that. They hold hearings all the time
mm-hmm.
on stuff that's not land use related, and there's nothing in the code that says you got to provide notice to some 500 feet, you got to provide notice 2 weeks in advance, you got to publish it in a paper in advance. None of that's in place.
Just posting the agenda.
So I'm kind of proceeding a little cautiously here in that do we want to subject this to some special public hearing standard that other public hearings that the council handles aren't subject to? I think that puts us in a riskier place.
My thought would be, why invent a new process? Why can't you just piggyback an existing process for the hearing and the notice of the hearing?
We don't have a formal notification process. It's not land use related. That's why.
Right.
And this is not a land use decision. The statute makes that clear. Whatever the result, now I could borrow from the land use processes. I could do that. But it
just seems administratively that's going to potentially bugger things up, just having to go through all that. If it's not the normal procedure for city council hearings to be noticed, then this is just another city council hearing. And hopefully, you know, the word's going to spread. Oh, they're talking about opening a big shelter, you know, in my neighborhood. I'm going to know about it.
There's also nothing, I don't think, about the permanence of these emergency shelters. Once it's approved in an area, is it permanent?
Forever, potentially.
Or is it temporary?
Potentially, there's forever.
There's no delineation that I see.
It's no different than any other use. I mean, once established, they can continue.
Yeah, it's an interesting use of the word emergency. Maybe they should change the word. They should.
I think
maybe they should say temporary shelter rather than emergency.
Spend some quality time with legislative counsel as they do their bill drafting. I mean, the definition's straight out of statute. And generally, when there is an actual statutory definition that's relevant to that chapter, we want to stick with that. Vertical evacuation structures? I don't know if we define that or not, Dustin. I'd have to go back and look. I remember we dealt with that as part of that land use amendment for the Hatfield. But that's a vertical evacuation. I don't think we went the emergency shelter route with that. Well, I know we didn't have a definition. I checked for emergency shelter.
Oh, you don't. Okay.
We don't. All right, so I have at R4 for a hearing, and just leave it as hearing before the council, and if the council wants to elaborate, they can. Sound good?
Yeah, and when you're going to present this to council.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, and they'll have to weigh that one. And so for community service uses, I added or emergency shelters pursuant to ORS 197.782 because that can be slightly different than the type of shelter envisioned in the existing language. And I think it got added in as, did I do anything with it?
Can I just get into one of those fussy little things that I like?
Sure. Where?
Well, sometimes you're putting footnote numbers in the columns, the zone columns, and sometimes you're putting them in the category column.
Right.
And
seems to me it ought to be consistent.
Oh, I see. Okay, I'll take a look at that.
But that's, you know, nothing for now, but if we're, okay, enough said.
Yeah, no, so I hear what you're saying. So community service uses, there's a new footnote 7. An emergency shelter proposed within a C2 or an I2 zone district shall be subject to a public hearing before the Newport City Council. Those zones don't currently allow shelter uses, whereas the C1 and C3 allow them outright. Okay. And the I1 allows them outright. The I3 prohibits them, and I think we ought to just roll the dice, keep them prohibited in I3. We have very little heavy industrial to start with. And I think it's highly unlikely we would ever have a shelter proposed in what limited heavy industrial we have. That's kind of where my thinking is. I can't imagine somebody would really want to go into a heavy industrial area anyway. That's probably your least compatible location.
Except for those people living in R1s and R2s.
All right, so moving along. To temporary uses, not too long ago we had reworked this to say, hey, look, you can live in an RV on the property while you are doing construction to a building, residential or otherwise. The legislature had set 24 months as the length of time when the event related to a disaster and you were either repairing or doing a full rebuild to a home as a result of a disaster. This last session, they extended that out to 60 months, and so that's what this language is about.
Yeah. Well, but we're not extending all construction.
The 60 months is just circumstances where the construction or repair is in response to a disaster.
To be like the folks from the fire.
I know what he's talking about, but that doesn't apply if I'm just building a house.
Correct.
Okay.
And remember, this is not specific to residential, but the same premise would apply. I mean, if we lost a whole, huge chunk and somebody had a small commercial building that was entirely destroyed by disaster, they could live in an RV while they were rebuilding it. I don't think that's a likely outcome, but we were keeping language a little bit flexible there. Residential uses in non-residential zones. Something in there. Where was it? Oh, here we go.
E.
Thought it'd be here, but
it's under sub G. A fourth member.
Page 12.
Well, thank you.
I think it was probably a session or two ago, the legislature said, hey, look, you have to allow affordable housing at street grade in your commercial zones if the property is owned by a public body or a nonprofit. Well, they stripped that out and just said you have to allow it, period. So that's what that change is. We can still toe the line, though. You know, we're not going to allow it at street grade in hazard areas, and that existing language, that's all still good. Transportation standards. The more significant change is actually to 14.48, not 14.44. I added a cross-reference in here that we should have had when we did the TSP work. 14.44 picks up circumstances where somebody's doing a public improvement associated with, say, a tenant remodel or redevelopment on an existing lot. 14.48 gets at the public improvements related to land divisions when you're creating multiple new lots. In either case, we accept an improvement agreement subject to specific requirements. The specific requirements are outlined in detail in 14.48. And 14.44 is supposed to just have a simple cross-reference over to that so we don't have to duplicate the language in both chapters. So that's what this, an improvement agreement as outlined in 060B through G. When you go to 14.48, 060B through G, which we'll get to in a minute, you'll see the details of what's in a improvement agreement. I'm scratching out the cash deposit, surety bond, letter of credit, because again, we're just doing a cross-reference over to 14.48, and that's where the surety language is listed. We had a bill that requires a specific new type for affordable housing. I'll point that out when we get there. Okay, so we do improvement agreements. If you're doing like a tenant remodel, we would allow an improvement agreement to be done. I'm going to use Harbor Freight as an example. They're going to be doing their tenant improvements in the old Builders First Choice building. It's 6th and 101. They're still working through ODOT review processes on some of the frontage improvement changes they have to make. They'll be eliminating a couple of driveways. They've got to deal with an ADA ramp issue, stuff like that, some sidewalk repair work. We went ahead and did an improvement agreement with them so that they could move forward with their tenant improvements.
I saw somebody in there
today. They have to have it done. They have to have this work done before occupancy, so we still have that hook there. But that was a way for them to have some confidence. They know exactly what the scope of improvements are. They just couldn't get to them before they wanted to pull building permits. So this is a way for them to continue to move the project forward. So land divisions. So this is where the improvement agreement requirements are spelled out in detail. Under financial, so it starts at B. This is all existing language that talk about provision of improvements, improvement agreements. Then you get to financial insurances, and this is where it talks about surety bonds, a letter of credit. And then the new one is, and this is straight out of that statute, one or more award letters from public funding sources made to a subdivider who's subdividing property to develop affordable housing. So
that's out of it. We can't change the wording there because subdivider is a weird word.
No, that's what they, I believe that's the language that was used in the bill. Subdivider is something we know. I mean, that's the entity that is subdividing.
But that's not just a developer.
Subdivider.
It's the subdivider.
I would have used the word developer there.
Sometimes you have somebody who's just doing the land division and they're selling off the lots for development. And other times you have somebody who's doing the land division and actual development.
All right.
Now, I've been seeing a lot of small manufactured homes. I mean, we're talking tiny houses going in in different locations, not necessarily anywhere in this city. Now, is that kind of reflecting of the subdividing the property? Can they subdivide into individual lots that are that small to accommodate affordable housing?
There's no law that I'm aware of that says you can create very small lots in the cause of affordable housing. We still have minimum lot sizes in different areas. We have that bill 3414 that didn't make it out of the last session. You guys had that material, which basically allows a developer to kind of waive certain standards. That's likely to come back in revised form for the short session. That could be a mechanism that somebody could use to say, I want to get a minimum lot size waived to allow very small lots. But again, you know, some of the things you start to run into with very small lots too is, I mean, there's only so small you can really go without causing yourself some issues with respect to getting your utilities in, your driveway widths, if you're going to park outside of the right of way. I mean, there's only so narrow you can really, really go.
I've been seeing, and they basically look like small street sections, but they're manufactured housing. They're probably 8x25,
mm-hmm.
approximately. And they're set up basically just like a subdivision, only they're just very small. They've just got a front, maybe just enough room to park one car in front. And
that would typically come in under an RV or RV standards. I mean, those are park models. We would typically view those as park models.
Yeah.
And but so a park model would be an RV park. And, you know, you would create the pad sites, power, you know, your utility hookups, that kind of thing.
But they could they incorporate that into some kind of a affordable housing development?
It can and is being done elsewhere, yeah. You know, we've had people tire kick. It's funny. We've had a few people tire kick about doing RV parks with tiny houses, and they don't want to do the capital upfront cost of getting an actual paved roadway extended into their property, utilities extended in, pad sites properly constructed. You know, if you have enough of those small units and none of them have like laundry facilities and stuff, then now you need to have a common laundry area. I mean, that's kind of where the RV code goes, and they don't want to take on that expense generally.
You know, I'm thinking of that manufactured home community on Northwest 3rd as you're going down at Denai Beach.
Right.
And I think that's some of them are regular, you know, manufactured homes, but there are several, I'd say there's at least six park model type.
Yeah, Doug Fitz.
Just in the same concept that you've been discussing.
And I've been seeing those pop up, you know, just in traveling around. I was going heading down into Florence. They've got some there in the burnout areas. So when you get into Otis, there's a developer that has actually come in and put several park models in and has just taken an area. So it kind of follows the same thing. I'm just wondering if they're using the affordable housing standards in order for them to get the okay to do these types of developments, because they really aren't following necessarily an RV park model. They're almost like their own little subdivisions, but they're just, rather than using a double wide or, you know, something more conventional in a pre-manufactured home, they're just scaling everything back. Mm-hmm. Which I think would be more on the affordable housing.
Like a mobile home park or something like that? But in
a tiny home. Mobile home park, but more on the scale of a residential standard.
Do you think more of it's like an emergency because of, you know, people lost their homes, they had to be housed somewhere?
It doesn't look like that. Mm-hmm. This looks like somebody that's had several lots that were burned out, but maybe has taken his property and kind of rethought what he was going to do with it and just came up with more lots. But it looks, it's designed, it looks like a regular subdivision. It's just scaled down to size.
You just kick me a note and you see one. I'd be happy to look into that and get some information.
Okay.
I suspect it varies depending on your location and what the circumstances are. I do know, you know, when you get into rural property, you're typically, you don't have a sewer system that you can connect to, so now you're dealing with some form of septic, which does force you to have a bigger footprint for it to work. If you don't have a water district, now you're talking about a domestic well, again, more area because you're trying to fit that in as well. And oftentimes it boils down to, I mean, people ask us, why don't you see a whole lot more tiny houses in Newport? Well, land value would be one major hurdle. I mean, to get the lot and to get the utilities into the lot, by that time, the person who wants to do the tiny house isn't going there. That's not going to work for them. The cost at that point is more than they can bear. So what you end up getting is what you get in Wilder, which is what 2,500 to 3,500 square foot lots with, you know, homes,
1,000 square foot houses or less.
But those are in the mid threes.
Yeah.
You know,
the Wilder homes are in the mid threes.
Yeah.
The smaller ones,
the new ones that they just built.
Yeah.
The new ones that they just built.
Those are all above 300,000 from the low up to a little bit higher, depending on, you know,
how you make it, design it, or whatever.
What was it? Two years ago, Dustin said there is no such thing as affordable housing without government subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
That was what you shared with us a while back.
That's still pretty true.
Keeps going up.
Tiny homes can be expensive too, depending on what you. I watch those shows. Tiny homes cost per square
foot. Yeah. I guess unless you do them manufacturing style, and then it becomes a prefab type.
If you do it on scale, yeah.
If you do it at scale, you'd be all right. But
some of that, like Adair homes, are.
Well, but Adair, they only take the concrete footprint in.
Yeah.
All the other costs are to the homeowner, whoever's buying that. They're responsible for that. So the cost that they share just for the footprint of the house in. So, probably. Yeah, they look really, really inexpensive, but they really aren't because they don't advertise the all the additional costs because they just throw that to the homeowner.
All right, I just have a couple more changes there in the procedures section. One has to do with the bill that we talked about that allows us to meet our legal notice requirements in a digital newspaper in addition to kind of your paper variety. And I noted here our intent is to stick with the News Times as long as they can continue to publish once a week. If they can't make that, then we're going to have to look elsewhere.
Is there
I think the News Times is going to transition to become the Lincoln Leader again.
Going to incorporate the whole county.
Mm-hmm. And is it going to be strictly a digital paper? Nope.
I think it's still going to try once a week.
They said they're going to start mailing out a bigger paper, more pages, more news.
News.
Yeah. We'll see.
And then the last one has to do with the decision timelines. There was a bill that went through that provides a little bit more time in certain circumstances, and so I went ahead and worked that in there under decision time. That's rare. Usually they're requiring the decisions to happen faster and faster. This is a rare case where they provided some additional time. But it's only in limited circumstances where you're dealing with residential structures, and it's kind of tacked on between the point where you do a tentative approval and you adopt a final order. Sometimes I'm a mixed opinion as to whether or not to stick it in a municipal code, but if the allowance is out there in statute, if it's not in the municipal code, we won't necessarily think of it. So that's the scope of the improvements of the changes. So
I have a definition question.
Yes.
So I noticed in that new section 5 on the financials that affordable housing subject to the affordability restriction and the site and then affordable housing covenant or on a covenant. So when we define affordable housing in the code, how is that restricted against the property in some way? And is that required or?
Depends on the context in the
code. I hadn't seen that sort of secondary requirement in anything except that section 5.
Does it say something about public money and that usually it's recorded, right? If there's public money, they record affordable housing.
But if they're taking advantage of an affordable housing clause, I'm assuming they're required to retain it as affordable housing for a certain period of time, or is that not defined in either state statute or local?
Well,
it's defined.
Yeah,
yes.
It's federal money, right? Federal CDBG or home funds is 25 to 30 years.
So
I used to work for a nonprofit.
Where we have multiple use property tax exemption under Chapter 3, that's one area where we deal with affordability. And because we offer that as a local property tax exemption, it's up to 10 years on the structural improvements. They have to have a certain number of units at either 60 or 80% median area income. There is a reporting requirement. Now, we've only approved one project through that. It was $1.6 million. It was Surfview Village. Surfview Village, the bulk of their funding is from Oregon Housing Community Services, and it's LIFT funding, and it was federal tax credit. Mm-hmm. They're under obligation to maintain those units at 60% median area income for, I think it's more than 30 years.
And usually you have
We have the documentation, so we don't require annual reporting because we have that.
Because they do it at the state.
Right, they do it at state level, yeah. And so we can rely on that. But if we had a smaller project that didn't have funding through Oregon Housing Community Services, didn't have that kind of, you know, state federal money that was putting them on the hook, then we would, if we gave them a local property tax exemption, we would require the reporting locally.
Okay.
And there's provisions for that in that code. It's, I want to say it's it's in chapter 3.20 or 3.25. You'd see it in the municipal code.
Where then city staff would have to go monitor that once a year. Used to have to do that where mm-hmm. before.
Mm-hmm. They'd have to provide reports. We could go do site inspections, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We proceed cautiously there because we have very limited resources compared to Oregon Housing Community Services. So
sure.
So that's the end of that particular work session item. I have one other one here if we have time I'd like to move on to. If this is
time.
Close enough, when we get to the regular session, it'd be great if you guys could do a motion to initiate the legislative process. I'll make the change to that one area that we talked about earlier, and then we can bring this back for public hearing in 35, 40 days, whatever it is, so we could get this done.
Right, Bill? A few minutes to talk about the format change on the minutes.
Yeah, we will.
Okay, new business, review draft affordable housing. CET code amendments.
Okay, I want to bring up a couple of things here I just want to talk to you about, and we can have a further discussion at another work session. So. On PowerPoint. Okay, what if I can. All right, what I'm showing you here are two slides. And one is for this is Surfview Village, the one that you're seeing the fees on here. That was 110 units. They pulled their permits in 2019. They finished construction in 2020. This lists out the full total cost that they paid. Now, they had the advantage of a Wilder tax credit transfer that's no longer available. But their total fees came in just under $250,000 for that project. You throw in the Wilder credit, now you're looking at $170,000 or $75,000 or something like that. If you go to this is market rate here. This is Windhaven 2. Their total cost. Substantially higher, in large part because market rate has to pay the CETs, the school and the affordable housing CETs, whereas by state law, your affordable housing projects are exempt from the construction excise taxes, both school and affordable. And we've spent some time through the housing production strategy talking about how should the city utilize the restricted pool of funds it collects as part of the affordable housing excise tax. And we're restricted to using that to deal with to multifamily development and market rate. And so.
Here, I'm sorry, but I'm really curious. Do you have any idea what the project cost is for this one?
Total value?
Yeah.
Not off the top of my head. I can get that for you though.
Okay, well, no, it's not necessary. I was just looking at a percentage, $683,000.
I can tell you
as a percentage of the total project cost.
Yeah, I can tell you the I know the Surfview Village was about 110 units is about $25 million.
Okay.
So
okay, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, but and again, Surfview was 2019. Construction costs jumped quite a bit between 2019 and 2022. And so I would anticipate the construction value on Windhaven was relatively high, even for the 78 units. But it's that differential that I would, that I wanted you to see, because I want to bring up the language now that I've put together. Now this only relates to the affordable housing excise tax revenue that we can collect off residential development. That by state law can only be used for development incentives for multifamily. And this is 3.20 here is the excise tax chapter. And I put the new language in here. See it. Subject to the availability of funds, net construction excise tax revenue from residential improvements shall be used to offset 50% of the construction excise tax authorized by this chapter for multifamily development to producing a minimum of 20 units, where such units are affordable to households with incomes equal to or higher than 80% of area median income. That statute, 197309, defines affordable as 80% or higher. It was intentional.
I know.
It makes your head spin around in circles because you're not used to thinking of it in that context. Right. But what they were trying to do was say, hey, look, we recognize if you're doing these affordable housing excise taxes, you're going to be hitting market rate with an additional upfront cost. You saw it for Windhaven. And so we want these development incentives to be tailored to help market rate, because we're already helping affordable with other pools of fund here. This one would be a development, you know, are supposed to help your market rate folks. So what I was thinking now, the way the statute reads is it limits us to how we approach that. We can, there's some options relative to inclusionary zoning, but we're not doing inclusionary zoning, so I skip past that. So then we're left with the voluntary incentives that increase the number of affordable housing units in a development, decrease the sale or rental price of affordable housing units in a development, or build affordable housing units that are affordable to households with incomes equal to or lower than 80% median area income. Now you see it flipped, which is, look, you can provide the incentive to a market rate project if the developer is willing to carve out some lower priced units and provide it to them if they'll agree to keep the prices down. Or you can provide it to them if the end result is going to result in more units on the ground. So what I was trying to figure out is, well, our collections over 5 years in this bucket are sitting around $260,000, okay? Not a huge amount over a five-year period. B and C probably aren't going to be attractive, and they're going to have significant regulatory burdens to monitor. So how do we start to dole this out in a logical way? And the one that only made sense to me would be to do A, and to put it in an ordinance where we're basically saying, look, we're not going to try to prove up that any given project's going to result in one or two additional units. What we're going to do is put together a programmatic way of doling these funds out to projects of scale that necessarily in the aggregate would result in additional units. And we'll just bake it in the ordinance and not track it. That's where my head wants to go. That's why the 20 units are larger. I think it would be very hard for us to say we're going to give an incentive to a four-unit project and argue in the straight face that that's resulting in an additional unit.
Yeah.
So
it you wouldn't needs have to, the money to if it's right. If it's 80 or less. I mean, it wouldn't really. If you have other funds or the developer or the subdivider or the nonprofit, whoever's doing the development, could get other sources of funding. Like, when we did a project, senior housing, when I worked for, I was the executive officer of a nonprofit. We had 8 sources of funding. But I see why you chose that language, and that makes, that, you know, makes sense.
And it's going after the affordable, it's trying to drive down the affordable housing excise tax for market rate multifamily. Obviously, affordable wouldn't even be looking at this because they don't have to pay that at all. Theirs is a big zero when they come through. But I'm going to, you know, again, that.
We don't seem to be having trouble finding developers that will do market rate housing, however. We do have trouble finding developers who will do affordable housing because of all the difficulties and expenses. It seems odd to use CET funds on developments that developers are already willing to invest in and people are willing to buy into. It doesn't seem to me to give them money helps us at all with the affordability of housing in this area. We're just giving people more reason to buy market rate housing because they'll get some help along the way. It just doesn't seem, there's nothing in this to suggest to me that we're getting more affordable housing. All we're doing is buying more market rate housing.
So are these?
But see, market rate's part of the supply that we need. I will caveat, part of the reason why we're having some success with market rate and Windhaven is a unique situation where the construction company that's related to this had held that property for decades.
Yes.
Yeah. So they didn't have the land cost to deal with, which is substantial.
Sure.
And so it's a bit, they're a bit of an anomaly. And once they do their last phase, I wouldn't expect to see another market rate project like that for a bit, certainly at that scale. Where would we have the land, frankly, for one that big?
Are these rentals? Aren't these rentals?
They're all rentals.
And so if you did the 80% or above, there would be a caveat.
But I want to be clear.
Extra.
We have to provide
lower income ones or no?
We have to provide this is the 50% of our affordable housing excise tax residential collections. It's a subset of what we collect. And the statute requires that it be doled out to multifamily 80% median area income or higher. That's what the statute says. Now, what we can do is we, you know, make it available as voluntary incentives that either result in additional units or result in price cuts on some of the units or result in some of the units in the market rate project being made available at traditional affordable or, you know, 60 or 80%. MFI.
So you could have a developer come in and do a condo project. Let's say he's doing multi-unit buildings, but he could do 3 or 4 that are market rate and then have like either single bedroom or studios that would be affordable. In a percentage, let's say, so could he be still get some of the benefits if he's doing 15-20% of the development's going to be affordable? In other words, he's going to have some market rate units in there, but then he's going to do a certain percentage of units that will definitely match that or meet that affordable.
How big is the project, Gary? What do you think?
Well, I mean, you're talking, you know, probably 35, 40 units. I mean, you know, just as an example, maybe three or four buildings, something similar to what they're doing at Windhaven. Not quite that scale. They would be more condominium type projects, you know, for sale type units, not necessarily rental units. But he would still carve out a certain percentage of those that would be small enough or, like you say, single one-bedroom or studios, that would be for sale units, but would still be at a reduced cost that would meet the affordable standard.
I hear you. Here's the challenge I'm running to in my head. I'm looking at $260,000 over 5 years. And do we put together an elaborate process for somebody, and these are elaborate processes for them to go through and demonstrate that certain units are going to be held at certain price points? Is it even cost effective for them? That's going to have to be a significant number for them to even want to do it.
Well, I'm
just putting this out there. Yeah. So if we've got $260,000 over 5 years, do we want to put that kind of process in place with the expectation that we may tap those funds once every 20 years? And then it's like, how is that administratively something we're going to be able to stay on top of? That'll be a pain if we're doing it once every 20 years and we got a special little process there set up for that. That's the part that I'm struggling with.
Right.
We don't bring in enough
to do that. Does $260,000 include the $169,000 here?
That, remember, that does not all go to that. Remember, we collect.
Oh, it's 50% goes.
It's 50%.
So that 80,000 or whatever it is, 85,000, is that included in that?
Yeah, you know, I'd have to go check, Bob, because this ended up at, that was a 2022, and the chart I have I'm looking at here would have been the, if they pulled permits after June, no. If you know.
Okay, I'm just curious.
I don't know.
Because that's a very substantial percentage of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're making it sound like that Windhaven, sorry.
Are we beaming up?
Stop it.
That Windhaven project paid a substantial chunk of affordable housing, more so than you would see typically out of, say, a residential project.
Right.
Yeah. Single family detached type stuff.
Hmm. Oh, but the funds we're talking about are only the ones from residential.
Correct. Remember, commercial and industrial don't have the same hooks on it. And we talked about cleaning up the balance sheet and moving some money around as part of HPS. We'll do that. But we're only talking about half of the residential collections, which have to be used as development incentives. And the only development incentives that are available to us are those that those three. We did talk about that, but the more I look at it, I think the market rate STC fees are going to be even higher. Our better shot would be just to reduce, you know, buy down the affordable housing CET for multifamily market rate. So that's how that's structured. When you look at this,
do we have to do this?
We have to. We can't just continue to collect and not have a incentive program.
But we have.
We're collecting it for that purpose. Somebody will take this to task at some point and saying, why are you not doling these funds out? Yeah, you're collecting it.
If there's not enough money collected to, you know, push forward the public policy, why collect it at all?
All right, so we have a 90-unit market rate multifamily project moving through permitting right now. Their affordable housing CET is going to be somewhere around $200,000.
That phase three?
Yeah. I'm just throwing that out there. And it's not like this developer hasn't paid affordable housing CETs. You're looking at them right there. That's phase two. Phase one, they paid as well. I mean, it strikes me as that is in line with what this is trying to get at for the 50%. Now, remember, we have other pools of funds through this that are much more flexible and can be targeted by policymakers at really your 60% median area income and or to address homelessness issues and all kinds of stuff. This spot can't be used for that. This 50% of residential collections can only be used for those three things I listed, since we're not doing inclusionary zoning. Those are the only three things we can use those for.
Let's see those three things again, could we?
Yeah.
the number of units, decrease the rental price, build affordable housing units.
So, again, so the, if it's a market rate project, the incentives are supposed to help generate more units, because you want more market rate units than would otherwise be built, because it's a part of it. I mean, we want afford, we want subsidized housing too, but we want it all.
No. Yeah, back to Dustin's doors. Yes. It doesn't matter.
Well, and right now, that's what we need is more doors.
We have 200 more units.
The language above in red is statute. Is that?
No, this is the that's the proposed language.
Proposing, yeah.
It's a concept. It's for discussion purposes.
Yeah. Okay.
By the way, let me, I'm going to show you something real quick. Let's go to slideshow. Okay. That's, over the last 10 years, that's what we've produced. Just so you, I mean, just for context, that's what's happening in Newport in terms of housing. Our forecast based on our population growth and for whatever it's worth, our historic population growth, and we went through the whole housing capacity analysis. We need 626 units over the next 20 years. That equates to about 32 units a year. We've been averaging 52, most of that in the last half a dozen years, as you can see. What we have in the pipeline, you can expect that trend with multifamily to spike again over the next year or two, because we've got Windhaven Phase 3 coming in for permitting right now. We have student 77 housing. More student housing coming in under permitting right now. So, you know, those are given projects. And then we're going to have some additional single family, largely out of Wilder, in terms of anything of, you know, that's more than a couple units here and there.
Is Wilder still going to put in, they're pushing for another phase early next year, or spring, aren't they? For like another 25 or 30 units?
Fowler's gonna go with they've got 9 more, which are gonna be estate lots there. They gotta build a small cul-de-sac for that. That's I believe their next step. And then I've just met with them, and their consultants are going working on the final development plan for 75 units on the other side of Harborton. 20 of those would be multifamily. The balance would be single family of various densities. And I'd say more than half of the single family would be what they just did with the 26. So fairly small.
Fairly tight, yeah. Lots. High density.
Yeah.
Small, well.
But when affordable. You say the other side of Harborton, where?
Correct.
How far?
East side.
North and east, depending on kind of how it flows.
Multi-family.
How far up? I mean, across from the pub where the disc golf course is? Or?
It would be, I think the east end would be across from the pub.
Okay.
And then extending west up until you get basically to
the church.
Almost to the church. Not quite there.
The multifamily, are those going to be like 4-unit buildings, 6-unit buildings?
The concept they have is another fourplex, kind of like the one Oxenholt did up there right next to the little commercial corner building. So it'd be, and they were looking at 20 units total.
20, okay.
So another one of the little
another
fourplex.
Another 4 or 5 of those, yeah. In this discussion on they used the, I've always wondered what this exactly meant. The word workforce housing.
That's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just what is workforce housing?
Like for
I don't like that term because
it's
a useless term. Yeah. Does that mean workers who work in the restaurants, workers who work at the fish plants, workers who fish on fishing boats? I don't understand what that means in terms of housing needs. We can't calculate it if we're just talking about workers, but we can talk about it if we're talking about the type of housing that that workforce needs. And I'm a little baffled by the use of that word in all of this. It needs.
Why would their housing needs be different than any other person's housing needs?
Well, because we were to do an inventory and determine just what kind of housing we needed for the next 20 years. And if we just say, well, we need workforce housing, we don't know diddly squat. Yeah.
It is a buzzword,
and it's useless. I'm sorry, I come out of the field of education. You want to talk about buzzwords, you know, all to hide the truth.
You're an asset to this community.
Well, I don't know about that, but
what I think we can say with confidence is that market rate in Newport is going to be above 80% median area income, and that's what this incentive is targeted at, above 80. We have to dole it out to multifamily projects above 80% median area income. And I don't know. I looked at the three options, and given the collections and the process pieces and that are associated with B and C and whether or not any project would even want to go through that, given the small amount of money we have, and the only one that made sense to me was A.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Can see that. Okay.
Well, this would be easy enough for us to set up.
Doors. There you go again.
Okay. All right, I'll bring this back in a cleaner format. I just wanted to have the discussion and kind of show you kind of what the challenge is there.
Thank you, Derek.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. Thank you.
You have been consistent.
Okay, let's moving along here. Upcoming changes to format since the regular meeting is being held off a bit.
Action minutes. So we've got we're going to be changing format citywide. On how minutes are prepared. This is largely because of really staffing issues with the city manager's office, and they've been backlogged because they staff a bunch of committees, and they've been backlogged because they can't get their minutes out in a timely manner, which is an issue for folks. And so our assistant city manager did a fair amount of research. He's the one who's been really pushing this work and brought in some samples from different jurisdictions. I believe a number of that, mm-hmm. a lot of that stuff was included in your packet.
Yep.
And you can see that there are a number of a much more streamlined approaches to mm-hmm. preparing written minutes. I think one of the keys will be time stamping that to the audio video so that people want the details. They know where to go.
Yeah, that's
in a 3-hour meeting to find the little
well.
Snippet of detail
that
they want.
Part of a city council meeting, and you can just pop right into the beginning within 10 or 15 seconds. Their markers are pretty good. Yeah.
So that'll help. And then the other is just, you know, being careful about, I think if you do a formal motion, that will get captured. So being, so for certain things, you really want to have captured, you know, that's one approach to do it. I think where we're having a discussion and it's a clear consensus discussion and we verify is there general consensus to proceed in this manner? We'll do our best to capture that as well. We have a contentious land use proceeding. We'll probably go with more detail at that point.
Sure.
Because that's important for policymakers. It's important for you guys where you have multiple hearings and you got to try to remember what certain things were said in the first hearing as you're sorting through the stuff in hearing number two. But it's also important on subsequent appeal. Granted, mind you, if it goes to city council, we're talking about a verbatim transcript at that point. So yeah, it doesn't matter.
That makes sense. What's your view of the change?
I actually think it's going to be positive, especially staffing and, you know, preparing minutes is quite the task. But yeah, I think, you know, I've had a chance to really review this with Eric, our assistant city manager, and he's lending to more of the Staten format. And if you really take a look at it, I feel like it's nice and sectioned off. It'll be easy to, keep the minutes. And like Derek said, any time there needs to be more details, we'll be working closely together to identify those moments where we need to keep it. But
yeah,
I think it gives.
I'd just like to say that I think over the last few years you've done a wonderful job on preparing those, and I can't imagine doing it myself. So congratulations on that. But I'm glad they're going to be relieving part of that burden.
Yeah,
I think you like the Staten. For me, doing minutes, I didn't like the boxes, but then that's because I wasn't really that great at.
I don't see that being a problem.
It seems like it's easy for us to read.
Yeah.
Page 138. You guys look those two.
So, yeah, if you want to take a look at those, you'll kind of see what they're going to start.
I'm weird.
At.
I read every one of them.
Yeah, this meeting will be the typical style, but starting all the meetings starting in November forward, we're going to go to that new format. So you'll see it for our November meetings, not this meeting.
I like how they sign. Would you have it signed too?
We're not going to do that. It just, that makes it a little bit more difficult.
It takes time to
just to try to make sure that we're getting the signatures. You know how that goes with the final orders.
Trying to run everybody down, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're on board.
I am. I feel good about it.
That's what counts.
Yeah.
My mom was a secretary of schools. That's who you go to.
Okay, the last item is.
Well, just a work program update, which was included in here. I'll get you a more detailed one. I'm kind of running out of space on this one for an upcoming meeting.
Okay, the work session is terminated. And good night to Dustin.